Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, as it continues on, we had Gulf War I, we had Gulf War II, and now we're in the middle of Gulf War III. But it's 10 years ago when Fallujah and all that stuff happened, and all the nightmare of Fallujah and what occurred and all the travesties and everything. So I thought we'd go back and talk to an expert on Fallujah, a guy that was there. So let's discuss that this evening and see what we can make of it. Patricia, are you there?
I sure am. This is Patricia Axelrod, and I am the director of the Desert Storm Think Tank and All Veterans Advocate. And before the program ends, I'm going to give veterans out there my phone number. So, at any rate, I am a professional veteran advocate, and I am a military scientist for peace. And joining us tonight is a man who knows about Fallujah, who's had his boots on the ground in the war, in the Middle East, in Iraq, in Fallujah, in 2004. And that good man who's joining us is Will Hopkins. Will, are you there?
I'm here, Patricia.
Well, I must tell you, folks, I am, and Doug and Will, I'm going to gush just a little bit. I'm so honored and pleased to have Will joining us tonight. And it's so important for us, we, all of us, to understand Fallujah and what that was about and to really understand this war in Iraq so that we understand that we are being manipulated for the pleasures and the benefit and the profit of the military-industrial complex as a whole. And Will is joining us. Will is a lifelong New Hampshire resident who served for 6 years in the New Hampshire National Guard. He was decorated for valor during a year-long tour in Iraq as an infantryman, including the 2004 Fallujah Offensive. And he also served in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. He served with the Guard. He was honorably discharged upon completion of 6 years in the National Guard. He is now and has served as a national member of the Board of Directors of Veterans for Peace. Now, imagine this. Here we have the Goodwill who has evolved to from warrior, dare I say, to a warrior for peace, a warrior for war, a warrior for peace now. And he was on the board of directors of the Veterans for Peace, and he now serves as the executive director of the of New Hampshire Peace Action. And we are so pleased to have him here, and he's going to tell us about this journey that he has taken since he fought the war in Fallujah, from war to peace. Will, so
yep.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, gosh. Jeepers. I know that sounds so corny for me to say jeepers, but I'm just so delighted. As we now, as the powers that be whip the public into a fury to demand war in Iraq, to pour back into the scarred battlefield of Iraq, I am one, and I know, Doug, we take a stand, and we're strong about it. Am I right, Doug? We're anti-war, and we're proud of it, aren't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just a big mess and everything. Will, can you tell us about what you encountered, what you saw, and what you, you know, what should we take from all this, please?
Sure.
How'd you wind up in the war over there, anyway? How'd you wind up in the military? How old were you when you joined up?
I was 20 when I joined. I'd taken second semester off from my sophomore year of college to teach skiing at a little mountain called Tenney Mountain in central New Hampshire. It's closed down now. And there was another instructor who'd done 6 years in the New Hampshire National Guard in our mountain infantry company. And he would tell me stories on the chairlift about how he'd go out one weekend a month and 2 weeks a year, and he'd hike and ice climb and rock climb and snowshoe and ski and rappel. And that he'd do it one weekend a month and 2 weeks a year, and that it was generally a good time. And this was in the winter of 2000, 2001.
So you were lured into the National Guard with a promise of a good time. Am I right? You were kind of like, and I say this with respect to you, you were kind of like a charming ski bum who taught people how to ski, and you figured out a way to continue to do this in a way. Am I right? And this is what you thought you were going to get out of the Guard, huh?
Yeah, well, and there were promises of school money, and so I signed up in the spring of 2001. I went to Fort Benning, Georgia, to infantry school and basic training over the summer of 2001, and I graduated, I believe it was August 28th, 2001.
And what branch were you in?
I was New Hampshire Army National Guard, but you go through the same basic Army infantry training regardless of National Guard or Reserves or active Army. So,
mm-hmm.
And so I graduated, and 2 weeks later, I was back at college and watched the World Trade Center fall. Knew that my time in the Guard was not going to be as much filling sandbags for floods and helping out in ice storms as I thought it would be.
Right. So take us from there to Fallujah in 2004. Now, what year did you get out? How you served 6 years in the Guard.
Right. So in
and,
May.
And how long were you in Iraq? And when from whence to whence?
So I hit the ground in Iraq in March of 2004, and I left in February of 2005, so it was about 11 months.
Wow. So tell us about Fallujah, as we are on the eve of Fallujah, and certainly there's been much discussion about Fallujah and the 10 years. This is the decade anniversary of the slaughter at Fallujah. Am I wrong to call it that?
I don't think so. Because I was in the Army and not the Marine Corps, my role in the Fallujah offensive was a little different. I was on what's called the cordon, so I was out on the edges, and my job was to make sure that people didn't cross in or out of the city. My squad shut down a street and made sure nobody crossed. But we sat there and watched while artillery continually barraged in. Bombers also dropped heavier munitions in. In hindsight, I recognize that most of what was dumped in there wasn't just munitions, which are bad enough, that killed people who were trapped in the city. But it was uranium.
It was radioactive weaponry. We call it the people who want to use this stuff and get away with convincing the world at large that it is harmless because it is called depleted uranium have been beguiled because this is radioactive weaponry. Am I right, dear?
I believe so. I mean, the current studies out of Fallujah are showing that as much as 20% of the children born there are dead within the first 2 weeks and classified as deformed. It's as radioactive as Chernobyl.
Well, just out of curiosity, since I did write all the training and the regulations for depleted uranium, as you're aware, did you get the 100 hours of mandated training on depleted uranium prior to deployment?
No, I actually slept with a box of 50 caliber armor-piercing dual-purpose rounds, which I did not know were depleted uranium until after. And nobody gave me any training that we were using uranium, that it still held radioactivity, or that it was coating even my 50 cal rounds.
Wow. Now,
see, that goes just back to the same thing again. General Shinseki, who just got fired as Secretary of the VA, had personally issued the order based on my input, mandating training for everybody on the use of depleted uranium, mandating thorough environmental remediation for all contaminated areas, and medical care for everybody. But then, as you've just said, and as we know, Fallujah turned into a radiological nightmare and all the other stuff that was distributed there, and has created a medical nightmare for the residents of that area and that community.
Right. And my
understanding and for the benefit of our listeners, and may I just interject this, for the benefit of our listeners who may not fully understand, if you're new to the program, let me make this explanation to you. Doug Rocky, who is the host of this program, was in great measure I say this with great respect to Doug, was in great measure part of and responsible for, in a way, the deployment of this so-called depleted uranium, really known and should be known as radioactive weaponry. So when he says something, here is a man who really knows the truth about this. I just wanted to interject that. So go on.
Oh, my understanding is that the half-life is in the neighborhood of 4.2 billion years. So the city of Fallujah will never again be a safe place to have a child or reproduce or live.
No, it won't be. Can you tell us, bring us back to that day in mm-hmm. front of Fallujah? You are on the perimeter, is that right?
Right.
Of the city? Can you paint us a picture of that day and that your experience as much as possible?
Sure.
You're on the outside and the bombers are going over and and the rounds are flying up in the air. Give us a kind of a picture of what you saw.
So we were very close to Abu Ghraib, and so I could smell munitions, and I could also smell human waste. Abu Ghraib was did not have proper facilities for getting rid of waste, so it I could smell that. It was hot. Although not as hot as it had been a month or two earlier. Probably every few minutes, there would be an artillery barrage. And it would usually be three or four rounds that would come in one right after the other. It seemed to be almost random where the rounds would hit. People were coming out. There were children. There were elderly
screaming,
people.
Screaming and running, or...
Why? Most of them were trying to get out in cars, actually. And some of them would then park their cars and try to cross on foot, which we allowed a lot more frequently, you know, especially children and elderly people. If they were on foot, we would let them cross. My understanding is my squad leader got into some trouble for that. You know, but there were people who were begging to get cars out, people with children. There was a woman who...
Did you stop them? Was it your job to stop them from going if they weren't children or elderly?
It was. I don't think we were actually supposed to let children and elderly out either, but I think National Guard folks, my squad leader was a 47-year-old father of two who worked in a glass factory. He was not somebody who... He was a nice guy, and I don't think he was able to follow that part of the order.
To turn back? Was it your order to turn back these people so that they would fall victim to the bombs and the artillery rounds and so forth, so they would die, essentially, to clean them out?
Yes. My understanding of our orders were that no one was allowed in or out of the city at that point.
I mean, what was the reason for that? I mean, it just doesn't logically make any sense at all.
To kill everybody, the highest kill rate. That's the bottom line here.
What we were told is that was because people were afraid that the high value targets in the city might sneak out, or that more munitions to fight might be brought in. That was what we were told. You know, as far as what was going on in boardrooms, I'm not sure. I certainly don't think that the policy made a lot of sense, and it was certainly very inhumane.
Right. So
to me, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, here we invaded a country without justification. We contaminated air, water, and soil. We, you know, put their government out of business totally because they didn't want to do what we asked them to do.
Yes.
We establish a puppet government. And then you got a city that we totally destroy, men, women, and children, contaminate air, water, and soil, and all the food. And for what reason? I mean, what reason did they give you, Will?
Oh, well, I mean, in the military, there were, you know, there were people who said that it was, you know, there were weapons of mass destruction, even at that point, at the end of 2004, when it was clear that that wasn't true. There were folks who were saying, we're going to the Middle East to bring the fight to those who would come and hurt our families. It was the common rhetoric that you would have heard on Fox News at that stage, is what we were being fed. Not that I bought into it. But.
So the bottom line, as you point out, is that you, you know what your order actually said, Will, just out of curiority? What would your order, how would your order actually have been read out?
That I don't know. I was an E4 specialist, so my squad leader and possibly my team leader read the order for the Fallujah mission, but, I was simply told by my team leader, to not let anyone in or out. And then he would let young people, children and elderly cross on foot. I did know that he was reprimanded because he allowed a car across for an old woman who was unable to cross on foot and was injured. And I know that he was reprimanded for that. Obviously, it was kind of hush-hush, but rumors fly in the Army, and we all found out that he'd gotten in trouble for letting an elderly woman cross in a car because she couldn't walk.
So let's get it straight, if I might, then. Just for the benefit of those folks who listen to Fox and yet listen to us, or for the benefit of those who want to succumb to the hysteria that that you hear revving up, the dogs of war pulling at the leash, so to speak. So for the benefit of those who don't quite understand what is happening, would you characterize this, Will, as a slaughter? Could you tell the truth about Fallujah so that people really understand what happened over there and why Fallujah is so important to the rise of ISIS and how these two, how Fallujah, the war, the slaughter of Fallujah, and today's ISIS, are co-joined. Can you tell us about that, Will?
Yeah. I mean, I think that for people to really understand what gave rise to ISIS, there are a few things that they need to get. And number one, it's that Iraqis are human beings who love their children as much as we love our children, who feel pain and who feel anger as any of us would if a family member were killed. And every Iraqi had lost family members, be it through lack of medical care and food through our sanctions through the late 90s, be it through any of our bombing campaigns since 1992, every Iraqi has lost family members. And when you kill people's family members, they will want to fight you. They will not want you to control their country. I joined the National Guard because I thought it was okay to say I want to defend my country. And in the minds of Iraqis, there are not three Iraq wars. There is one Iraq war that started in 92 because there have been bombings, sanctions, more bombings, invasion, more bombings. In their mind, the government that is in power is a puppet government of the United States. And our continued involvement is what ISIS is using to recruit people. They're giving Iraqis the chance to stand up and fight the empire who has been making war against them for the last 20-plus years. As long as we are taking that bait and we are saying, yes, we're going to go to war with ISIS, we are giving them the platform they need to recruit the next generation of folks to fight.
Well, one of the suspects that I've got with the ISIS people that too many of them are just average Iraqis that got fed up with the occupation. And then, the U.S. military, when they're supposedly rearmed them or rearmed the army, Iraqi National Guard and then gave them training. And then now the military is all confused why these guys are doing so good. It's sort of like, how dumb do you have to get? First off, you piss them off. Then you take everything away. Then we're going to rearm them and train them, and then we're going to expect them to like us.
Right.
Yeah, and we wonder why the people of Iraq are so furious and why ISIS has been so successful in just a short period of time. Consider just from the Battle of Fallujah, just recently, the takeover of Fallujah again. Is that about right, Will? I mean, think about that.
It all makes perfect sense if you just consider the reality that wherever you go, humans, that people love their children, and that people love their families, and that anger at seeing a family member killed is enough to drive most people into fighting and being willing to die to fight against the entity that killed their family.
You know, I think that's really what we have to understand. We really have to personalize it, don't we, if we want to understand the anguish of the Fallujah people and the Iraqi people. If we want to understand this, then it's important to simplify it. And actually, I think that's a really wonderful, if I might be so bold as to call it, a simplification of what's going on over there. Those folks have been under attack since Desert Shield, and in the summer of 1990, actually. And before that, the Iraqi people and the Iranian people were at war. And conservatively speaking, there was 1 million Iraqi and, I might add, Iranian people who died. Those wars were all just ending when, in fact, America launched war against Iraq. And that's what it was, I might add. So what I'm saying to you is that this nation has been under attack, and they are worn out. Wouldn't you say that's true, dear Will?
Absolutely. I mean, I think about how, at that point, 23 or 24-year-old man, 11 months living in Iraq, has permanently left scars on my psyche, and how I am traumatized. And I can't imagine what it's like for a young man of 20 now who has lived his entire life under not knowing if a U.S. bomb is going to blow his house up tonight or if a stray bullet is going to catch him or his family. And I can only imagine that is enough to make someone want to do something to change the situation. And sadly, a lot of people turn very quickly to violence as being their only solution.
And in fact, haven't they been shown that by America, who has indeed continued, and her allies, and I say this, I'll be frank if you'll be earnest, it's time to really look at that war and understand what's happening. We have been bombing them, hurting them, killing them, man, woman, and child, for now, since 1990, is that not right, Doug?
Well, yeah. I mean, we started the operations in the spring of 1990, you know, and so it's been an ongoing thing. And basically, I mean, we can go back. There was a major conference, I guess probably 98 or 99, at Cambridge University in England. And you can pull that up. It's a book called Sanctions on Iraq, and it's at Cambridge University. Campaign against sanctions in Iraq, and you can read all about it then. So it's been an ongoing thing. Iraq had a very stable, very advanced society prior to our deciding to destroy everything.
It sure did.
And what is so horrible, and as we all know today, and everybody's affected, the chemical weapons that Iraq did possess prior to Desert Storm, during Desert Storm, were given to them by the U.S. military, and then we destroyed them. And then now we found the residue and the other stuff still left laying out there. You know, what affected us and has affected everybody else. So we have a medical catastrophe beyond comprehension that we created. I mean, Will, as you reflected on all this stuff and you looked at all the health and environmental effects, what were your thoughts?
Well, a lot of it was, pure self-interest, you know, worry about my own health. I mean, I was on the Battle of Fallujah, so I was certainly exposed to radiation. I had 50 cal rounds that were on the bunk above my head for a good portion of my deployment. I certainly went past burn pits a lot. It was never my job to monitor a burn pit, but you know, I've also been exposed to burning armor, and so a lot of it is, I've wondered what the long-term effects of all of that is going to be. But I also, in my more reflective moments, think of the children of Iraq, and how there's probably not a one who's not going to experience ill effects from what we've done ecologically to the air they breathe, the water they drink, and the place they live.
I think one thing is important, as you talked about the battle, and you talked about artillery upon artillery, all different types. We basically totally destroyed the infrastructure of that city, releasing not just all the radioactive weaponry, but all of the toxic compounds from agriculture and education and industry and medicine all over that whole region, that whole city. It's just a toxic wasteland. I mean, on your troops, did you see any medical problems immediately with the military personnel you were with, or did that start coming on later?
Or with the Iraqi people. Tell us what you saw with the Iraqi people, too, dear.
Well, with troops, I mean, there were minor things, like my hair fell out. My armpit hair fell out while I was there.
What? Tell me what your armpit hair was doing. Tell me again.
It was falling out.
Your armpit hair.
And that was something I saw a little bit of with others. I was told by my medics that it was just from my sweat glands opening, and I don't think that was
possibly
the truth.
Let me get that straight. Forgive me. I just want to clarify that. Did your armpit hair fall out? Did it get dark? What happened?
Yeah, a lot of my body hair fell out. My armpits were totally bare by the end of my deployment. I kept my head shaved the whole time, so I'm not sure about my head hair as much. And it all grew back, but that does suggest to me that possibly the uranium had something to do with it. Everybody had, things like twitches in their eyes. And certainly within a couple of years of coming home, there were psychological problems. We had a number of people who were locked up behind bars, mostly for violent crimes. We had one guy who has recovered but had brain tumors pretty quickly after Iraq. It's hard to say that to draw straight lines to what we were exposed to, but I have to imagine that some of what we've seen is a direct result of being exposed to that stuff.
So with that said, if you experienced that, Will, and you saw your colleagues, your men in arms and women in arms also experiencing this, what do you think, as we talked about at Fallujah, there's a very high incidence of cancer, as we know, in Fallujah. And as you pointed out, the children, the infant mortality rate is very high. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. I mean, from studies I've read, in Fallujah, about 20% of children are classified as deformed and dead within the first 2 weeks. Also a very high rate of miscarriage. That it's not a safe place to have children or to live.
Right. And so Will, you have had an extraordinary journey as a young man. And how old were you when you went into the Guard and went over there? How old?
I was 20 when I joined the Guard. I was 23 when I deployed to Iraq.
Uh-huh. So 23. And how old are you now, Will?
I'm 34.
You're just a young puppy.
And Will, you are now in New Hampshire, and you are working with Peace Action. Can you tell us exactly what you're doing now in New Hampshire? Tell us about Peace Action and how this journey from Fallujah to Peace Action came about.
So, even while I was in Iraq, I never really fully bought into what I was doing. I didn't believe the stories about weapons of mass destruction. I didn't agree with the idea that we had any right under international law or moral obligation to be involved in a war. So I was opposed going in, and in hindsight, I wish I had had the courage to refuse service, as many of my heroes, Camilo Mejia, Aiden Delgado, Stephen Funk, Aaron Latata, a number of soldiers refused to serve under the grounds that it was an illegal war. And I do wish I'd had that courage. But for me, the living with the labels coward, convict, traitor, that at least my companion in the military...
Like a traitor? Who was calling you that? Who was calling you a traitor?
Something.
Were these names you're calling yourself?
No, but those are things that I heard other soldiers calling those who were refusing to serve. The label convict is something that I would have certainly had. Most anyone who was refusing to go to Iraq at that point was doing significant time in prison. And that those labels would have been applied by certainly folks in the military. And in my mind at that point, I thought most common lay people would apply those labels to me. In hindsight, I think people would have understood what I was doing, or at least many people would have. But I didn't have that courage one way or another, and I went and I did horrible things. I came home, and I was left very afraid of speaking out. I didn't want to talk about it until I was out of the military. When I got out in May of 2007, one of the first things I did was call Dennis Kucinich's presidential campaign. I live in New Hampshire, and we have about 18 months every 4 years where there are presidential candidates around every corner. And I called up Dennis Kucinich's presidential campaign and offered to volunteer. And I remember talking to his media coordinator, who said, well, what do you have for skills? And I let him know I was in an MBA program, and I was a marketing focus, and I let him know that I'd finished my bachelor's, and, you know, he was kind of like, yeah, that's great. You know, do you mind making phone calls? And I said, no, I can make phone calls. And he was like, okay, well, I'll hook you in with an intern. Is there anything else? And I said, well, I came home from Iraq a few years ago. And he said, we need you tomorrow morning at this tavern. You're going to be on camera. So be ready to speak to the press. And his tone completely changed. And, from that moment on, I introduced Dennis around New Hampshire a few times. I organized for him, and folks with New Hampshire Peace Action recognized that there was a New Hampshire Iraq war vet who was working for Dennis and asked me to do some speaking on panels and alongside a film called Soldiers of Conscience about conscientious objection to war and about my experience in Iraq. And I ended up about a year after the primaries, I ended up on the board of New Hampshire Peace Action, and then eventually our director left, and I took over as executive director in 2009.
Yeah, Dennis is one incredible guy. I had the pleasure to work with him and spend time with Dennis a lot. He's my hero and personal friend. And I remember, you know, the two of us would be all over the place. One time we both flew into Seattle. They had the TV stations there, and they interviewed me, and they interviewed Dennis, and everybody else is trying to figure out what's going on. And then we went to a conference and a breakfast together. And, Dennis has done more for veterans than probably any other congressman. He's one of the leading congressmen. Now he's retired, obviously, from Ohio. But he was one of the leading congressmen as far as helping all of the ill and sick veterans and getting medical care and doing the congressional investigations under the House oversight. So, I mean, God bless Dennis Kucinich. I mean, people are alive because of Dennis Kucinich's work.
Yeah,
he's committed to peace and anti-war activity. He's a great guy. I'm sorry. Go on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just as far as, you know, who Dennis is, I believed in him thoroughly, and that's why I got involved with him first. He's somebody who, if as a people, we were looking for wisdom, we were looking for somebody who looks for common sense solutions to problems instead of somebody who's a slick politician who's good at fundraising. I think he was kind of the ideal of that. A deep thinker, a kind person, a person who gets the nuances of situations like the war in Iraq, and it's certainly a huge loss from the U.S. Congress.
Right, and of course, for the benefit of those who may not know this, he did run for president. He did not win, obviously, but he did run for president, and now he is retired from the political arena, the active, the gladiators, which is what I might call Congress.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now tell us about Peace Action. You say Peace Action. What's Peace Action?
So Peace Action at the national level is the largest peace organization in the country. They have over 100,000 members. I just called my national executive director to check in on that number. And over 100,000 members nationally.
Wow.
Our niche in the peace movement is both as an organization that is helping to organize, kind of serving as an umbrella and helping to organize other organizations, but we also have a very specific place in the lobbying arena and in legislative work. At the local level, if you go to New Hampshire Peace Action or Massachusetts Peace Action or Peace Action Maine, the work there is going to be primarily organizing rallies and marches and speakers and films. But also they'll be sending things out to their membership, asking them to call Congress on legislation. I'm actually at an airport right now on my way to D.C. to do some lobbying.
You're in New Hampshire now. Where do you live in New Hampshire? What's it like? Cold, I'll bet, huh?
Oh, it's very cold. and since I stopped teaching skiing, I have much less use for wintertime. I live in Belmont, which is a little north of Concord, our capital city, kind of central New Hampshire. And I live on my wife's family farm, actually. We have cows and chickens and lots of hay fields. So it's
how lovely. May I, if I could, I'd like to ask you, just in case we forget before this program is over, would you please give all of your contact information and give it slowly so people can grab a pencil and write it down? This is about peace action, and there's quite possibly a peace action group in your backyard, listeners and people who are tuning in right now. So you might like to find out about peace action. So why don't you give, please, the national number as well as your number, okay, Will?
Absolutely. So I'll start with my contact information, which is you can email me at Will, W-I-L-L, at nhpeaceaction.org. And you can also get in touch with me by phone at the office, which is 603-228-0559.
Can you repeat
that again? Sure. 603-228-0559. And the national organization is peace-action.org is the website. And there are a bunch of different folks you can email there. I would recommend talking to our field director, Judith LeBlanc, and she is, I believe it's J-L-E-B-L-A-N-C.
Judith LeBlanc. Judith LeBlanc?
Yep.
All right.
And I could give the national number that you can call in and get in touch with Peace Action to find out where your closest chapter is, and that is 301-565-4050.
Could you repeat that, Will?
Yep. 301-565-4050.
You know, one thing that I found very interesting, and both Patricia and I go back to the Vietnam era, we're a year apart, so we got involved in the Vietnam stuff, we got involved in all Desert Storm, got involved in all this stuff in between. But I know for us and for others involved, all of us that were warriors were dedicated warriors, but at the same time, we've become dedicated to peace and trying to get justice and trying to get environmental cleanup and trying to get medical care.
Yes.
Do you run into the same problem I think that both of us have run into, where other individuals look and say, wait a minute, you're a warrior and now you're doing this?
Yeah, sometimes people are surprised to find out that there's such a thing as an anti-war veteran. The reality of working in the peace movement is you quickly discover that a predominant theme is that everyone has been affected by war in some way. There are people who they lost their brother in Vietnam, or there are people who watched a father deal with PTSD, or and then there are a lot of us who went to war ourselves and have turned in a very visceral way against this idea that it's okay for the ruling elite of given nations to pit their poor people against each other for control of land and resources, which at its core is really what war always is.
It's unique that somebody of your young age has realized that. I mean, so many in the military, and even individuals my age in the military, they're still yay, rah, team. Yeah, we did it. We were always there, and we were doing it. Everything we did was right, and we were justified in killing. But then what I've learned and what we've discussed, and Patricia, you and I have discussed this ad nauseum, is the fact that the veteran in his subconscious understands the truth and justice and what is really right. But in order to belong to a group, whether the VFW, American Legion, DAM vets, whatever it is, in order to be a warrior, you have to go along with the nonsense or you become disenfranchised.
Sure.
Yeah, it's about suspending reality, isn't it? Isn't that really part of what this is all about? Tell us about this, Will. You remember?
Yeah.
How did they get
you
to do these things?
It's not easy to convince someone like me to engage in war. I've always been a pretty gentle person. And I had a lot of help coming to grips with my experience in Iraq from supportive friends and family. For those who are still supporting war, who are veterans, it's something that I totally get because you have to go through this phase where you recognize that what you did is not good and noble and true and right and just. You have to go through a phase where you recognize that you were used and that all of the pain that you endured, all of the pain that you inflicted, was something that was for means that are not honorable, or for ends that are not honorable. And that's a really hard pill to swallow. So I never get angry when there's a veteran, particularly those who have just come back, who are just enraged to find that there's a veteran speaking out against war. It's something that I can actually really understand because it's a painful experience to have to accept that what you've done is wrong.
You know, I think what you've just described, and both we've discussed it before on this program, otherwise, is really the crux of everything that's happened from Vietnam since, and that's the concept of moral injury.
That's
so
right.
Moral injury moral is the injury. Fact that we all know what is right based on our Judeo-Christian upbringing, but then we got into the rah-rah John Wayne and Rambo crowd, and we accepted the other stuff in our conscious mind, and then in our subconscious, we truly know what is right, and then when we confront all this stuff, we have a massive crisis. And I think that's why we're seeing such incredible levels of PTSD. I don't think, obviously, the shell shock and the going from terror to tranquility back and forth in a nanosecond is a nightmare. But the really in-depth stuff, this moral injury, is catastrophic. I mean, for yourself and for me, and I know for Patricia, Will, do you find working towards peace and justice and environment and everything is really more helpful than anything else?
Absolutely. I credit my own ability to function as a human being to my work in the peace movement. It's a place where I can talk through what I did. I can make sense of it. I carry this guilt over when I had firefights. I laid down hundreds of rounds, and I don't actually know which of those hit people and which didn't. But I know that I did things that were bigger than me as a human being, as a soldier. And so making sense of that has been a really hard thing. But I know I turned a corner when I first had a meeting with a congressperson who, from the reports I'd read from other directors of peace action, had always disregarded us as hippies. And that congressman had to sit and listen to what I had to say and changed his position based on what I had to say. And I knew that.
Did he change his position? Did he do that?
This is Charlie Bass a few years ago, and he was actively supporting the second surge in Afghanistan. And I talked to him about my experience in Iraq, but then I talked to him about counterinsurgency theory and where exactly we stood with what counterinsurgency theory, which. Just for the record, I think is complete mythology. I don't think that there's a single instance in history where counterinsurgency theory has worked, meaning you can stand on people long enough that they just stop fighting.
Counterinsurgency? Is that how it's defined, that you can just stand there?
That's kind of a loose interpretation of counterinsurgency theory, that if you if you occupy people long enough with enough soldiers, eventually people will stop fighting and give in. I don't think there's an example in history of that happening. But it does hold in counterinsurgency theory that you need to have a saturation level of one combat troop per 28 civilians, which is almost 600,000 combat troops in Afghanistan.
Wow. I think one of the other things that I find fascinating, the military since antiquity has fought over ground. In other words, terrain control.
Yeah.
Do I control this area? Do I control this city?
Right.
But as we're seeing in the reality that I've had to come to face, and I'm thinking to me, Will, you can explain this too from your perspective, this isn't about terrain, because you can control a city with your military troops,
right,
but there's no way to control the people that live there. And the minute you leave or let down your so-called anti-insurgency activities, all of its services again. So
right.
I guess the whole concept of war, well, I'll control this city, and therefore it's mine, and therefore you can't have it, is all kind of a waste of money, a waste of resources, and a godly waste of lives.
Absolutely.
And let's bring this up. Not only that, but let's face facts. It is that which bred ISIS. It is this which has resulted in the extremist group called ISIS, a group dedicated to vengeance, really, as you point out, because we have killed their families. We have killed. Is that right?
That's my analysis of ISIS, that this is essentially a group of people opposed to the policies, the imperialist policies that we've laid down in the Middle East. It's a group of people who largely have lost family members. It's a group of people who feel that they have no choice but to turn to violence to fight to change the future of their region. It is arming people without dumping arms and funding into a region, and dumping munitions and bullets and troops into a region, that causes the instability that in this case gave rise to ISIS.
Right, indeed.
Exactly what we're doing.
Hey,
so,
Patricia, before we get on, we only got a couple minutes left here. Next week, we're going to have another very special guest. Will, this is an incredible year on, and you're always welcome to come back again. Next week, we're going to actually have an expert lawyer on the VA legal aspects, and what do you need to do to sue the VA and win, aren't we?
Yep, let me just point this out before, because we are approaching the end of this program, and we want anyone hearing this to tune in. Coming up this Sunday, of course, will be Will, and we'll... Just this program you're hearing now and the Sunday next, Kevin O'Connor, attorney Kevin O'Connor, will talk about the Federal Tort Act. And this is the way that you sue the suckers. And that's what I call this program, although Doug keeps telling me we cannot call it sue the suckers. I say let's call the VA for what they are, bloodsuckers. Suckers. And
one thing was horrible with the VA, up in Minneapolis, VA just hit the news again about 48 hours ago that they were altering the documents and altering records. Well, as you came back and when your unit came back, did you have all of your medical records and training records, or did you find your records, your unit records, that disappeared like all of ours?
I think I found most of what I needed. I think the NCOs in my unit were fairly competent about keeping track of that, so I believe all my records were intact, or very nearly intact.
Did you get a copy of the post-deployment physical assessment form 2796 that you could fill out and then keep for your records as you need medical care?
Oh, geez. I hope so. I haven't checked, though.
You might want to check that. You know, you're talking to an expert, of course. And the bottom line is, in the course of this discussion, you have exposed the fact that you were exposed to radioactive weaponry, and it's important for you to document that just in case, God forbid, you and or your family were to experience forgive me for saying this, it's sounding delicate, but the consequences of the use of this radioactive weaponry.
You know, it's all of the exposures that we're looking at. I mean, the burn pit, we absolutely have the burn pit memo, Will, that directs medical care at the VA for the health effects. And we've got the internal, like right now, coming out of the Warren G. Clinic in Washington, D.C., we got the airborne hazards registry exam and the medical care for that. And then when we look at the same thing, and Patricia, you and I have worked with, and we'll get it to you via the email, but we got the internal physicians direct us from the VA out of Vision 11, directing medical care for all these exposures, acknowledging the health effects. And
so
yet that is still
out.
Hidden not only from the soldiers, but it's hidden from the doctors, isn't it, Patricia?
So let me reach out to those veterans of Fallujah who were at Fallujah, or any veteran who's within our hearing who has had boots on the ground in Iraq, Afghanistan, wherever it might be, where there have been the use of weaponry, where firepower has been laid down. The bottom line is that we want to help you. This program is dedicated to you veterans, the soldiers, and the families of the soldiers, and we want to be there for you. So I want to encourage you. I must be just about over with right now. I want to encourage you, and Will, and this is why we're saying this, to give us a call or to contact us if your health, if you're curious about your health, if you need, if you want to learn what you might have been exposed to, soldiers, veterans. Give us a call. My name is Patricia Axelrod. I'm going to give you a phone number, 775-412-5980 and or P. Axelrod, that's A-X-E-L-R-O-D, Paxelrod, 1675 at yahoo.com. Doug, do you want to give some sign-off info?
Yeah, well, we got the other thing, too, is, ladies and gentlemen, make sure to go to GaryKnoll.com. And, you know, their PRN and get the Killing Our Own, the other documentaries that Gary has done. Gary has been instrumental in getting the truth and the information out. He was instrumental in getting the homeless taken care of and forcing that issue through the VA. So all these documentaries are out there. The information is out there. Will, have you had, we need to get this stuff to you, have you had an opportunity to see any of these documentaries either before or since then?
I've read some reports. I have not seen documentaries on the use of uranium munitions.
Well,
it's one of those things out there. Again, you know, up there we've got in New England, got God bless Bernie Sanders. I can't think enough of him. He is my personal hero. He's been a personal friend for many years. And God bless him. I mean, he's been instrumental in getting medical care for the veterans and forcing the VA to come about and do what's right.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, New Hampshire's, I mean, it's beautiful. It's called the Granite State, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
It seems to me there was an old man on a mountain or something at one time that I saw.
Wait a minute. What was that?
We're losing Carol Shea Porter this cycle. She's been a great champion for veterans. It's been one of her one of the things that she's really laid down as her focus as a congresswoman.
That's really, really good. Do you have any last things you want to talk about or say, Will?
Oh, just thank you so much for having me on the program, and I'm looking forward to the next time.
Oh, we're looking forward to the next time, and I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, so to speak, for joining us today and giving our listeners a look at what really happened in Fallujah.
Okay, well, thank you, Will. Thank you, Patricia. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Gary. Let's keep working and getting the information out, and God bless America, or at least we hope he does. But we got to remember, if we're going to ask God to bless America, we got to do is what is right under God's eyes, not what's right for economic and political gain. So take care, everybody, and good evening.